there are alternative ways of looking at sustainable development and or specifically development.
Climate change in itself is highly regressive. So anything you're doing to try and stop climate change will disproportionately benefit the poor and the vulnerable. There is a almost unprecedented opportunity here. It's not often that having relatively negative starting conditions actually makes it more likely that you'll succeed.
Today we are discussing a topic close to my heart, as I feel the environment deserves more of a voice. Continuing with the 1994 to now policy paper series that URSA published as a contribution to the SALDRU South Africa at 30 Years of Democracy conference, we will be discussing the policy paper on environmental policy in South Africa from 1994 to now, A Climate for Development by Brent Kluter and Bradley Kent. Since our democracy in 1994, South Africa's approach to sustainable development has reflected the shifts in global sustainable development frameworks. Where policy initially prioritized economic growth and social development as a separate function to the environment, it evolved to recognize the interdependence with the environment. Despite progress, South Africa remains highly vulnerable to risks associated with climate change, and this is exacerbated by socioeconomic inequalities, governance challenges, and a historical dependence on carbon-intensive power. In today's episode, we unpack developments in the world of sustainable development policy. How does South Africa rank internationally? What can we learn from the past? And what is required to transition into renewable energy or a low-carbon model? What data is required to facilitate a better evolution? Joining us is Brent Kluter, the Director of Connect Economics and an economist with 16 years' experience in policy related to economic development and climate change in Africa, and Bradley Kent, URSA's own economic consultant. I'm Margot G, and welcome to URSA's podcast series. It's a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. So, Brent, let's start with you. You have had 16 years of experience in environmental policy, economic development, and climate policy across Africa, and now found yourself the director at Connect Economics in Edinburgh. How did you arrive here? Did you always know you wanted to be an environmental or development economist?
Thanks, Margaret. Yeah, it's been an interesting journey. I mean, I fell into economics because I lost a struggle with actuarial science in my first year at university. So I didn't realize there was an option until I started studying. But then I quite quickly realized I really enjoy economics and the opportunity it gives you to understand, you know, the world around you. And then after I'd finished studying, I learned it was possible to be an economic consultant in South Africa. It's another thing I had realized. And then I got a job in Johannesburg. And then when I arrived there, I realized I was supposed to be a development economist, which was all very exciting. So then I started life as a development economist. And then while, you know, working on kind of general business, private sector development, business environment type work, I got the opportunity to start working on climate change. And to me, climate change at that stage was simply an interesting regulatory problem. That was quite new and exciting. So I didn't quite understand the importance or the heft of the situation. And to be honest, if I'd known the size of the challenge, I might not have, you know, dashed headlong into it. But yeah, then I, you know, started working on climate change quite quickly. A couple of people left the organization, and before I knew it, I was, you know, kind of leading on climate change work, and that's how I fell into it. And then over time I realized, you know, it's actually a much broader and a much more interesting field than I thought. And yeah, I guess for the last probably about, quite close to 15 of those 16 years, you know, I've been mostly doing climate change work.
Wow. It certainly is a very urgent topic, and I am only too happy when I hear more and more people getting involved. And Bradley, what about you? What was your experience like writing this paper? Your biggest surprise, and do you have any plans for moving more formally into development economics after this research?
Thanks, Margot. So that my experience writing this paper was kind of a learning experience for me, and word gets around very quickly about the few climate specialists that we have in this country, and Brent's name kept coming up. So I jumped up at the opportunity I was presented to write a paper with Brent, and yeah, just such a huge learning opportunity for me. And yeah, just basically at any opportunity I had with learning about, you know, the full evolution of policy and everything that we built in this paper, and any opportunity I could, I basically just turned myself into a little sponge and kind of just absorbed as much information as I could. Presenting the paper was also a huge honor and kind of an experience that I'm hugely grateful for. And sort of plans going forward, there is some exciting stuff that Brent and I are actually taking further with this paper, still staying in the environmental and climate space, probably leaning more on the sustainable development side. But there are some interesting co-authors that we've spoken to after we conferenced the paper down in Cape Town a couple months ago. Can't say too much yet. We'll leave that for the next podcast. But yeah, the exciting thing is that the plan with this paper was for us to sort of set the scene, to sort of put some feelers out there and say, you know, where are our shortfalls in the paper? We don't want to write this paper and it be, this is what we think, this is, you know, all we know about this. We wanted to basically set the scene and have experts in the field give us insights so we can kind of take this very important topic further. So yeah, very exciting.
Yeah, it's a great paper and it really gives such good context to the evolution of this policy. And that takes me to the next question, which I'm going to direct at Brent. So in this paper, you unpack the evolution of sustainable development policy in South Africa. How would you describe the current state of our environmental or sustainable development policy? And practically, how do we rank?
Thanks, Margot. Yeah, that's a big question. I guess the sustainable development environmental policy in South Africa, I mean, it pretty much is the same as the story in most policy areas in South Africa, where we have amazing intentions, amazing, you know, kind of plans and strategies, and very, you know, high quality research being done in South Africa, and a lot of very committed people. But we struggle a bit on the implementation, and I think this is something we've seen ever since 1994. I mean, South Africa was actually ahead of many countries in the world, in the sense that ever since democracy, we've really understood the link between environmental, social, and economic justice in South Africa, and particularly the impact that environmental degradation and unequal access to resources has on the poor and vulnerable. So that's always been a focus area in South Africa that we've been trying to address. I guess also, like at the time, like most other countries in the world, the idea was always to, you know, to get become rich and then become green, or become rich first and then become greener along the way, which unfortunately we did okay at until about the early 2000s. You know, towards the end of the 2000s, we started struggling in the becoming rich bit. And if anything, on a per capita basis, we've started becoming slightly poorer since then. And I think that's really where the, you know, kind of problems emerge. So again, in South Africa, the problem is that we have very good frameworks. We have, you know, we have very good legislation in place for a lot of this, but it's just not resourced well enough. You know, so as I say, almost every area of policy in South Africa, there are capacity gaps and there are funding gaps and there are resource gaps. And the reason for that, I guess, is just because we have this enormous socioeconomic backlog in South Africa, which we've been trying to address. And that's always been the priority. I think over time we've understood that it becomes more important, you know, and that, you know, addressing the environmental leg of the, you know, sustainable development can help with the other legs. But it just, we haven't quite gotten there. So in terms of international ranking, I wouldn't say exactly where we are, but what I will say is we were definitely towards the front of the pack initially. And I think as resources constraints have started biting and as trade-offs have become more severe, I think we've fallen back, we've fallen back a bit over the last, you know, decade to 20 years.
Okay, interesting. And there are two points there that that I want to pursue. How siloed would you say the legs of the policy are, the environmental and the development? Do they speak to each other much or not?
Yeah, no, look, that's a general problem in South African policymaking, is that everything is done at the departmental level. So there are quite significant silos. There are efforts, there are structures put in place to try and break down those efforts. It's been recognized as a problem, but it hasn't been that successful. So I think probably one of the main things, you know, in terms of sustainable development, and particularly in terms of climate change, has been lacking in South Africa has been a strong central driving force, you know, so the kind of presidency taking the lead and driving this forward. Now, we've had efforts to address that. For example, you know, the Presidential Climate Change Coordinating Commission that was implemented, you know, that eventually became just the PCC, is a great step forward, and that has an important coordinating role, and it assists, you know, the other departments and so forth. It doesn't have the full power of the president being the driving force. So it's outside of the structure, trying to pull the structure together, as opposed to being the focal point at the top that, you know, that kind of drives everything okay. together.
Okay, so then why then is it no longer effective to treat environmental, economic, and social goals separately?
So that's a good question, Margot. And I think that's something that came out in the paper, is that through the years we've learned how policy has had to adapt through the various changes. And there's been a shift from, as Brent mentioned, in the early stages, I think it was Gier and Asgisa in that era, it was grow fast and everything will sort itself out. The environment, sustainability, everything will come. And I think now, as mentioned, policy silos, it's a real issue, and it's something that needs to be separated, is that environment and climate are not the same. And specifically, those policies need to be looked at individually in their own departments, but they have an overarching focus on growth at the end of the day, which is what our paper speaks to, which is sustainable growth and sustainable development. And I think that's something that's now finally coming to the core, is that we cannot ignore climate and we cannot ignore environmental issues. We've learned in the last sort of 10 or 15 years with our energy crisis, is that the environment is inevitably going to start speaking back if we aren't listening to the policy. Because we all knew, you know, load shedding was coming, but certain policy measures were not kept up to date, and we had to learn the hard way. And now we're only catching up eventually through, you know, just transition and kind of getting our way into a more sustainable space. It's a very interesting space we find ourselves. I mean, Brent and I were actually chatting a few days ago. And interestingly, if you look at how quickly some of the African countries have transitioned in the last sort of 10 or 15 years, South Africa is the fastest growing country in Africa and the whole continent, but is one of the quickest in the world in terms of its transition. So there's a glimmer of hope, but it also means that, you know, we can't just keep ignoring the fact that there is a very pressing issue that lies beneath that, being kind of you know, the job problem, which we also address in the paper, which is our socioeconomic problems and what happens to the coal mining sector and things like that. So yeah, it's a very heavy layered question. So, yeah, feel free to jump in here and add your two cents, Brent.
Thanks, thanks, Bradley. Yeah, no, I think that's a good question, because I think it's to come back to Margaret's original question: what's the reason why we can't continue, you know, trying to address these things, the three things separately? And I think the key issue there for me is just resources. I mean, as we've moved over time, each of these three problems we've seen in South Africa has been difficult to address. We haven't done a great job of addressing, you know, economic growth has pretty much disappeared over the last decade and a half. Social, we're not making social gains as a result of that. So the resource base has been shrinking in South Africa as opposed to growing. So I think we simply don't have the luxury of trying to do these three things, you know, individually anymore, because I think we're just slowly falling further and further behind. And as we've been trying to argue in the paper, I think there are new ways of doing things that's being raised. That means it is possible to address these three things in a way that actually is more efficient than trying to do them individually. And you know, where you end up, you know, creating synergies, which is a word that's often misused in economics, but that's really what it means in this context, is you're trying to create these kind of virtual circles where improvements in the one area leads to improvements in the other. So really, I mean, what that means in simple terms is just every rand of investment goes further, because that's a rand you don't have to invest three times. It's a rand you invest in one of these areas, which then creates benefits in the other areas that you didn't have to also invest in. So I think this is an idea that's been reflected in the way South Africa has thought about sustainable development over time. So as you know, we mentioned in the paper, you know, from 1994 to 2009, the emphasis was very much on growth and development. So, you know, grow, and then once you've grown, you'll have the resources to become a bit greener. Since 2010, you know, there's been much more of a focus on the impacts of climate change and a realization that climate change is a real issue that's going to have a negative impact that's going to have to be managed. So we started thinking much more about climate conscious change from then, or how to, you know, to keep the economy resilient to the impacts of climate change. And then quite recently, from I think from 2020 onwards, the whole idea of using climate action as a growth driver has come to the fore, which is a little bit comes back to the idea, you know, internationally of the kind of a green stimulus. And so these ideas are all there, they're all growing, but they still, even here, the idea is still using these other things to support growth or to develop growth. And where there are environmental co-benefits, they're very much seen as that. They're seen as things that's incidental to the project, not core to its being. And I think that's probably where there's an opportunity for us now to start to try and do something different in South Africa, because we've had a lot of good ideas since 1994, but unfortunately the policy space, a lot of them look very much like the same ideas dressed up slightly differently. So we haven't really tried things that differently since 1994.
Interesting. What would you say are the same ideas dressed differently?
Well, look, so in terms of economic policy, it's quite clear. We've tried to have an import, you know, kind of import substitution drive in South Africa. And we've called it different things, and we've focused on different areas, and it's been called, you know, recently it's been called localization, and it's been, you know, it's been added onto the, you know, as part of the green growth agenda. But it's essentially still the same way. And essentially we've been looking at trying to develop industries by looking at them in isolation. So you look at an industry and its value chain, and that's kind of where your emphasis and your focus lies. So there hasn't been enough of an understanding of the intricate links between different sectors in the economy and different areas. And as a result of that, we've often ended up with policies that are, you know, counteract each other. You know, so rather than synergies, because of these silos and because of the way we've been doing policy, we've actually often had like kind of negative, you know, negative synergies or negative economies of scale as opposed to positive ones.
Interesting. I like what you said about moving towards climate action as a growth driver. And I'm going to ask you, Bradley, you know, South Africa is amongst one of the most biodiverse and most climate vulnerable countries. How do nature-based solutions offer a way forward, especially in the South African context?
Yeah, so this is a powerful and sort of heartbreaking paradox. South Africa is one of the most biodiverse places on the planet. We have such a unique ecosystem, our natural heritage that people travel all over the world to experience. But at the same time, you know, we are highly vulnerable to climate change. In fact, you know, one of the sort of most vulnerable on the African continent, but in the next 10 years, as Brent and I were doing some modeling about it when we did the CVM, some work with a previous project we've done, you know, we are kind of encroaching on that, could be one of the most vulnerable major cities, looking at Cape Town, so that Johannesburg, on the African continent. And, you know, this could, in the next few years, double the global average, which is quite scary. You know, we're facing more frequent droughts, extreme weather conditions like we've seen in KZN, you know, in parts of the northwest and closer to home in Johannesburg, which we've seen severe changes in weather patterns through the seasons. Those are some things that we've had to witness. And that's where the nature-based solutions, you know, I think come in. These are essentially strategies that use the natural functions of the ecosystem, such as, you know, our wetlands, our forests, to help us solve these societal issues. And just in our case, you know, these can be incredibly relevant. Instead of building more expensive brick and mortar infrastructure like dams and things, we can restore wetlands to manage these floods, rehabilitate catchment areas, improve water qualities, and conserve biodiversity to strengthen our very vital food system. As we know, we're such a hugely dependent on our local agricultural sector and local produce. So what's exciting is that nature-based solutions don't just help with climate adaption, they also support the livelihoods and create jobs and build local resilience whilst addressing, you know, these kinds of issues. South Africa is in a fairly decent position to lead this space, as we brought out in the paper. We have a strong foundation of ecological knowledge. We sort of understand the value of the ecosystem services to our economy. Nearly 3/4 of GDP is directly tied to them. And many of our industries, such as, you know, fishing, tourism, other forms of agriculture, you know, depend heavily on, you know, healthy operating ecosystems. So nature-based solutions offer a way to sort of include communities in a meaningful way, and that pushes closer to a transition. They do rely on local knowledge, and this can be community-led, and they can drive inclusive economic opportunities. And this is especially important, as we've seen sort of in the more rural areas. I think what's also important is nature-based solutions can break this sort of vicious cycle that we find ourselves where, you know, climate impacts worsens inequality, and inequality weakens climate resilience, and then we kind of just have this cycle of poverty which kind of reiterates itself and goes further. And this degrades our ecosystems. And we all know that, you know, leaves the poor worst off. You know, it's things like access to water, fertile land, and, you know, protecting the most vulnerable in society from these disasters. It's especially relevant in South Africa is cost effectiveness. We don't have the sort of endless fiscal space. In fact, in many municipalities are financially constrained, as we've seen with some of the audits that seem to have come out recently. These municipalities are struggling with basic service delivery outputs, and nature-based solutions, you know, could be, you know, a cheaper alternative to implement and maintain these municipalities in the long term, while reducing costs and responses like floods and droughts and things. Especially, you know, if you take an example like eThekwini, this is something that I think could definitely be put in place. And then, yeah, just to circle back, you know, how we spoke about, there is a glimmer of hope in South Africa. The National Adaption Strategy and the, I think it's called the Draft National Biodiversity something, Biodiversity Economy Strategy, I think. They both explicitly reference the role of nature-based solutions and how we can build climate resilience while still creating jobs and drive rural development. And I think this is hugely important, especially in the context of South Africa. And in these two documents, there are local examples from various communities and sort of how we can look at those. They've done a few case studies, and I think that's very, very important.
Yeah, I think from a sustainable point of view, it means long term, and unless it can fit into some kind of nature-based system that works, it cannot be sustainable. So I'm very interested when we hear these things, almost as though it's a new idea, but it seems to me that it should be just the way of being.
Yeah.
Brent, do you have anything to add?
No, I think Bradley summed it up very well. I think, but just to reiterate the point he made about, you know, South Africa warming at roughly twice the global average. I mean, that's a thing I think people often forget in this debate. So
yeah,
when the rest of the world is talking about 1.5, which we probably at this stage, I mean, people aren't quite ready to call it, but the odds of us keeping climate change to below 1.5 degrees more than pre-industrial levels is vanishingly small. So that means 3 degrees in South Africa. So that means, you know, our average temperatures are going up by 3 degrees, you know, not well above pre-industrial levels, not 1.5 degrees. And it gets even scarier because obviously when people start looking at, you know, 1.5 and 2 degrees, 2 degrees is 4 degrees in South Africa. So that really just shows you it's urgent everywhere, but it's particularly urgent in South Africa to try and build resilience. And as Bradley mentioned, I mean, part of that resilience to climate change and part of good adaptation is creating, you know, the capacity, you know, creating skills, resources. Yeah, so you need strong social systems, strong economic systems, and strong environmental systems in order to adapt to climate change. It's not just a case of how vulnerable to the physical impacts you are. There's also all these other factors to think about. And also, I think Bradley's point about local accountability is really important, because if done right, these nature-based solutions, like I say, you need detailed local knowledge. If that translates, the structures that generate that also hopefully then generate more local accountability, local input into the political process, which then leads to better service delivery outcomes and all of those things we've struggled with in South Africa. So at the risk of making it sound a little bit like a silver bullet, which obviously it isn't quite, I mean, you know, nature-based solutions are a very useful tool. It's something we should definitely try in South Africa.
Definitely.
On a larger scale.
Yeah. And when you say that South Africa's temperature is rising twice as fast as the global average, why is that? Is that because of behaviors and activity in South Africa, or are we just receiving the outcome of global behavior?
No, unfortunately, we're receiving the outcome of global behavior here. I mean, so climate change is a global development. So there's certainly things you can do to make your local area less or more resilient to climate change. But the extent with which the actual climate in an area or the temperature in an area rises is a result of these large global climatic processes, which, you know, we have very little control over. So yeah, it's not our, we can't do anything about warming at twice the difference, but we can certainly do something about becoming more able to deal with these increases in temperature.
Okay. So then, Brent, given South Africa's high carbon intensity and exposure to the climate transition risks, how viable is the shift to a low carbon inclusive growth model?
Thanks, Margaret. That's a great question, and it's one that I love getting. The reason for that being is it's often, I mean, the way it's phrased, it's people often start off with that as a reason why you should be careful about transitioning in South Africa, how it's going to be difficult. And I mean, and no one argues with that. I think everyone agrees that transitioning everywhere is going to be difficult, particularly in South Africa, somewhere that's so carbon intensive. But the good news is that a lot of this carbon intensity comes with inefficiency. So really, transitioning in South Africa gives us an opportunity to implement, you know, kind of new technologies of, you know, where there's a lot of gains still to be had to become more efficient. I mean, as we've seen, particularly over the last couple of decades in South Africa, I mean, the old carbon-intensive growth model pretty much has broken down in South Africa. So it's not like it's really a viable alternative to go forward anyway. It hasn't been delivering on, you know, on its problems. It's becoming less efficient. It's moving backwards. But then also, importantly, you know, almost a greater risk is because we're so carbon intensive, if the rest of the world transitions, we're really in trouble. Because then we lose the little bit of competitiveness we have left in the South African economy is then lost. So then we sit with a, you know, kind of massive contraction of the economy. And, you know, and that's one of the key factors of resilience. So even though, you know, in a low carbon world, there'll be much less physical impacts. But if in that low carbon world, South Africa ends up with a high carbon economy, then it'll contract significantly. So then it means, you know, it'll just become even more difficult to have the economic and social improvements we're trying to make in South Africa. So in a way, this high carbon intensity in South Africa, it's actually really provides us with an opportunity, because a lot of the interventions that in other places are slightly more marginal, I think, as we've seen, you know, with renewable energy in South Africa, it's just a no-brainer here. I mean, renewable energy is already the cheapest electricity, you know, electricity supply option in South Africa. So really, there's a lot of efficiency gains to be had here. And on that note, we've also, I mean, there's been, you know, Cambridge Econometrics did some modeling for the PCC a year or so ago, which we reference in the paper, that basically showed that even if the rest of the world doesn't transition, so if the rest of the world stays pretty much on course to where it is now, and South Africa moves to a low carbon economy, we still do better, because we increase the, you know, the efficiency of our economy increases, so we become more competitive. And then, you know, there's still options like exporting coal is still open to us. You know, obviously the first best option always is for everyone to work together in the global economy and us to contain climate change, because all the studies, all the modeling shows that it's much cheaper to limit climate change than it is to try and adapt to the impacts of climate change. That is not a controversial point. So the first prize is always let everyone work together. But if everyone doesn't work together, it's still in South Africa's best interest to try and decarbonize, simply because of all the efficiency gains that's to be had in the economy. So we won't get nearly as far in decarbonizing on our own as we would with support from the rest of the world. So we should keep trying to engage, you know, in international forums and try and you know, move the whole world towards, you know, towards a kind of milder climate future. But whatever happens internationally, it's in South Africa's best interest to start decarbonize, you know, it's significantly faster than we have in the past.
Yeah, and we certainly have beautiful resources, solar for one. We at least have sunshine almost throughout the year, so definitely something we could hone in on.
No, just on that note, Mark, I mean, and don't forget about our wind resources, and don't forget about the amazing things you get when you combine those two, you know, which are, you know, a different, you know, which produce at different times of the day, and all that stuff. So no, so there really, we South Africa has been blessed with renewable resources, potentially even more so than we had in natural resources originally. So we've got another opportunity here. We should use it wisely.
Yeah, definitely. So, Bradley, the REIPPP is often cited as a success story in renewable energy. Could you tell us a little bit about that and what lessons can be drawn from it for scaling up green investment and public-private collaboration?
Thanks, Margot. Yeah, so I don't know if it's entirely correct to call it the REIP, but yeah, Brent and I just call it the REIP. It's far too
I was
cumbersome
also
to say,
wondering.
yeah, no, REIPPP. Yeah, we call it the REIP. Yeah, it's sort of a standout example, I think, of what happens when public policy creates really good conditions for private sector participation, especially in this climate and in environmental space. And it's kind of been described as, you know, South Africa's, you know, taking the right steps towards renewable energy. I think that's definitely well deserved. You know, what the REIPPP did was it created good participation between government and private sector, and it kind of finally got them at the table, and the conversations that needed to be happening were actually happening. And it set the vision and the rules, and things like transparent bidding, clear procurement targets, financial guarantees, things like that from government side. And then, you know, from private sector, you've got obviously capital, technology, and, you know, any operational know-how and technical insights coming from the private sector. And this kind of created what's become known as the fastest growing renewable energy sectors on the continent, which is what we spoke about earlier. And, you know, I was actually surprised to see this actually in a graph which Brent brought out in a study that he's just finished up. I think it was it two or three times larger than the second most renewable, fastest growing African country, Brent, if I'm correct. it's three times that, yeah. So just to put that into perspective, I mean, we were up against the likes of Egypt and Nigeria and fast-growing economies, but our transition to renewable energies was three times that of the countries that were second and third in that graph, which is huge. So what's really remarkable is that this happened despite, you know, all of economic and political changes at the time, which was about 3, 4, 5 years ago. And even after we lost our investment grade, as solar and wind projects, they kind of kept coming online, and the cost of renewable energy dropped significantly, particularly because of the risks that were well managed, and sort of the regulatory environment gave investors a little bit more self-confidence that they needed, that there was sort of light at the end of the tunnel. And I think REAP had many positive spillovers. It boosted sort of local financial markets. It brought in a huge international influx of expertise in this space. It opened up more inclusive models of ownership in terms of sustainability. And we saw community trusts, you know, owning shares in renewable energy projects and reinvesting those profits locally. You know, this wasn't perfect. You know, there were delays. There were many hiccups, but, you know, overall, the program showed that with the right sort of balance between policy certainty, technical insights, and sort of collaboration, green investment can sort of flourish even in a tough context like, you know, South Africa found itself. So, yeah, what does this mean for the future? I think it's a big lesson that we can take from the REAP model and apply it elsewhere. And, you know, to think about something like water infrastructure, waste management, and, you know, as you mentioned previously, nature-based solutions. It all comes back to sort of the framework of a structured procurement and private alignment approach. If we scale up across various sectors, you know, we can pair it with inclusive planning and capacity building at the local level. You know, and we can look to transform our economy while, you know, making sure that it's resilient and specific climate resilient. And ultimately, it's that it's equitable and sustainable. And essentially, you know, that's what we found with REAP, was that it reminds us that climate action, it's not just about the targets and the emissions and the carbon budgets and things like that. It's really about using it in a way that unlocks, you know, real potentials for growth, and innovation and sort of inclusion and things like that. Brent, you want to add in anything?
Thanks for that, Bradley. I mean, I think the thing that always impresses me, you know, through the whole REAP experience is how successful it was despite all the challenges. I mean, it was a bit of a stop-start process. You know, at some point it looked like it wasn't going to continue. And yet in the end, it did manage to unlock this market. And while it managed to procure a lot of much needed electricity for the South African grid, I think the real value in REAP was just creating the conditions in the market to then respond when eventually, you know, a couple of years after the start of REAP, when the regulatory conditions changed, there was a industry ready to respond to that, which if REAP wasn't there, I don't think that would have happened. So what REAP did is it created a whole army of project developers, of project financiers, project, you know, consultants, everyone involved in this market that knew how to do renewable energy projects and that were familiar with this and that understood the risks and that was ready to roll this out. So that to the extent that, you know, today there's much more power being procured, you know, by companies and being wheeled over the grid. So actually the kind of centralized procurement that REAP was, it's not playing that big a role at the moment in this African market. So the African market actually flipped from a kind of, you know, public sector led centralized procurement model to a much more open, much more diverse private sector led model. And I think REAP deserves a lot of credit for enabling that.
Okay. Very interesting. How does this compare to the JETP project, and what role can the Just Transition play in addressing inequality in South Africa?
Okay, well, I'll kick off, Bradley, and then you can come in. So no, that's a very important question, because I mean, the thing that people forget about climate change is that it really is, climate change in itself is highly regressive. Climate change hits the kind of poorest and most vulnerable in society much harder. It disproportionately impacts, women who's disproportionately tasked with, kind of gathering fuel wood, gathering water and all of those services, staying behind in the rural areas, working, the kind of land, while often, often men are working in cities and so on. So the impact of climate change on, in that perspective is really bad. It also disproportionately impacts the young. They lack the resources to adapt. They lack the agency to impact decisions. So climate change in itself is highly aggressive. Also in South Africa, the areas of South Africa that is most vulnerable to climate change, but based on the kind of modeling, we expect the most significant impacts, physical impacts of climate change, are the poorest provinces, which is a particularly severe and ironic blow to development in South Africa. And then the other thing also to remember is climate change significantly worsens both educational and health outcomes. That you get a different spread of diseases, you get new diseases, you get a reduction in productivity, you get heat stress and a whole bunch of diseases linked to that. That makes it much more expensive to roll out health services. So particularly in a country like South Africa, where a large portion of the population is reliant on the public health sector, that's very problematic. And same with education. I mean, again, it apart from from climate disasters obviously impacting physical infrastructure, if you think about education in South Africa, I mean, we still have a lot of rural schools with inadequate infrastructure. There is not even proper plumbing. So if you imagine the classic example of a teacher and some kids sitting under a tree taking their lessons, I mean, it's a lot less fun doing that when it's north of 40 degrees Celsius. So those negative impacts, that, I mean, education is one way of trying to increase equality or access to opportunity. So it's another way that the climate change negatively impacts that. And of course, there's all kinds of employment impacts and other things. So really, climate change in itself is highly regressive. So anything you're doing to try and stop climate change will disproportionately benefit the poor and the vulnerable. But ha having said that, obviously, this transition is a structural change in the economy, and structural change has always caused disruption. And with that comes winners and losers. So areas, particularly areas where the kind of coal value chain is concentrated, and we know in South Africa, there are big mines, there are big power plants that essentially drive the local economies in towns. So these things, wind down and disappear. Those towns are left in the lurch, and that has significant socioeconomic impacts. So it's very important that the transition is just, and that the benefits and the cost of the transition is distributed equity across society. So we can't push all the costs onto the people least able to deal with it. And that is, I think, is where the JITP in South Africa is playing a very important role in trying to get international finance to try and ensure that we can invest in the kind of activities which can be normal economic activities, but they can also be, kind of mitigation and adaptation interventions linked to climate change, to create livelihoods, to replace what's being either lost or being displaced and moved, in the in the move to a low carbon economy. And that is, and I think people forget just how important that is for the kind of societal license, and the kind of political support to actually push through the transition. I mean, the transition is not something that you can decide, a couple of people in power can decide that it will happen. You need broad societal support for it. And I think the good news there is, I mean, at least point we're trying to make in the paper, and that if done right, the transition should make South Africa a more equal place with less poverty and, with less unemployment and with better growth prospects.
Definitely. Anything from you, Bradley?
Yeah, I think Brent hit the nail on the head. There is a very interesting, it's actually a book called Donut Economics by Kate Raworth. And I do recommend, if you have not read it, to do so. It's a book that basically speaks about how we kind of need to rethink and kind of throw out all of our old models of how we understand economies need to grow in terms of pursuing GDP and development and growth, and it kind of refocuses and puts society and ecological issues and socioeconomic issues at the core. It's something that I think is coming through quite interestingly in the just transition, like Brent mentioned. It's not just, it's kind of like a seesaw analogy, because you've got one side of the seesaw saying, you know, we just want sustainable development. We want to reach, you know, this full off-grid, carbon-free, first world country approach. But at the same time, it's a very complex issue at hand in the sense of South Africa's workforce and our heavy industries like coal and, you know, dominated by the kind of dirtier industries, shall we say. But if you look at job numbers, you know, we can't ignore the fact that, you know, we can't just simply say, all right, we'll somehow create jobs in educating people to, you know, repair solar panels or something. It's much more complicated and it needs a lot more analysis. So something that we actually picked up at the conference we presented this paper at, there was some delegates actually from the JETIP who presented on the, I think, the third day. And that's kind of what they were saying, is that it's, you know, they constantly feel that they get a lot of slack from stakeholders that, you know, why don't they just create all these new jobs? And it's not that simple, unfortunately, because, you know, there's a lot of upskilling that needs to happen. And it's a whole new industry that we're creating. And, you know, the private sector, it's great to see that we're transitioning and we're pushing so much into cleaner energies. But it's not necessarily that public sector is being sort of anti-transition or making it more difficult, but it's that they're just trying to constantly keep the balance between jobs, employment, equitable transition, like, you know, ensuring that the transition is just, as Brent mentioned. So yeah, it's definitely something that I wouldn't want to be involved in. My hat goes out to those people involved in it. But I think it's definitely something that in the paper we speak about how it's not such a easy solution. So yeah, I think understanding the complexity of where transition and growth prospects for South Africa fall, and then bringing in the argument that we have about sustainability. If we can focus on sustainability, we can address looking at inequality and climate and environmental issues. So yeah, it's like a three-pronged sword.
Definitely.
Thank you. If I can just add to what Bradley said, that I mean, look, it's good to stay realistic and pragmatic. So I'm glad that Bradley raised those points. I think we should just be a bit careful not to get overly negative, because we already know, look, even in South Africa at this stage, we've seen from the modeling, a fully renewable energy system creates more jobs than we currently have in the coal-based value chain. We know that. They're not all in the same place, though, which is where it's very important to bring the just transition into that, is to make sure that we don't have a poor, you know, a couple of communities linked to the coal value chain disproportionately carrying the cost of transitioning on behalf of all of us. But I think so. I think particularly from us, I mean, the attractive thing of this new growth model, which is not an idea we came up with, and lots of people are talking about this, is that if you do it in the right way and you try and create a just transition, you are addressing these inequality and these poverty and environmental. These things are all baked into the model. So unlike today, where you're trying to get, if you're just ignoring environmental for the second, even in terms of growth, look, largely you create growth, and the model in South Africa is you create growth. There's more resources, there's more taxes, then you redistribute the taxes, and that's how you deal with inequality. The two processes that both have to work perfectly for it to get the right outcome. Whereas in this model, you know, the kind of more, the fairer outcomes is built into the model. So there's no second step that you have to do. If you do it right, and as Bradley said, it's going to be difficult, you know, but if you do it right, you will be addressing a lot of these policy issues all at the same time, which is something to be scared of, because in South Africa, obviously every policy always tries to address, you know, a bunch of different outcomes, often all of them poorly. So I hesitate whenever I say this, because I know it's a risk to do this. And it isn't necessarily a silver bullet, but yes, it, at this stage, it's at least a shiny bullet. So we need to at least try and see and see how close to silver we can get it.
Definitely. And then Brent, in your paper, you speak a lot about the new growth model. Looking forward, what data and modeling tools and institutional changes are most critical to turning South Africa's new growth model from theory into reality? How can we make it easier to transition with this model?
Ah, you keep the easy questions for last. Key to this new growth model is understanding. So it's understanding where these synergies are, how they look like, and how you unlock them, and then measuring the impacts. So what this means, if this model works correctly, then building resilience will help to, you know, strengthen, so, you know, economic, environmental, and social systems, which means you'll then be spending less on disaster recovery and adaptation in future. Now, it's very important to be able to prove this, because if you don't prove this, then, you know, those initial expenditures are just seen as, you know, as expenditures or operational expenditures. They're not seen as investments, which is really what they are. For them to be considered investments, you have to then link them back to the benefits you get later on. And this is where, I mean, South Africa, for a developing country, has very good statistics. You know, SA is one of the, you know, kind of most highly regarded institutions, you know, in the world, particularly in the developed world. I mean, they've done a lot of work. It's good, but they also work under resource constraints. So there are still a lot of gaps in terms of understanding, you know, kind of particularly climate impacts at the local level, understanding employment at the local level, and the links between all of these things. So we have to address these data gaps. So we need to be, you know, understanding exactly, you know, what's happening where. And we also need to be understanding, we need to sharpen up our fiscal frameworks a bit. Because in the past, we've done some work on, you know, looking at environmental expenditure and trying to link that through the budget process, right from national government down to the provincial government, and, you know, and even local government level, and that's at this stage is not really possible. A lot of the provinces and use kind of different markers for different types of expenditures and call things slightly differently. And although there's a lot of work being done in order to you know, to align these things, you know, on a continual basis, we don't have the granularity of information yet to kind of link kind of adaptation, investment in one local government, which then in 5 years means that when the next climate disaster happens, that cost has been reduced. So that's the kind of information really that's the first thing to try and do, is to try and get the information so that you can build the models to, at a very granular level, identify these benefits and also to correctly identify investments as investments and not make them look, you know, so they don't look like operational expenditure. So that's the one thing, is trying to get the data right. And the other thing, which is even more difficult, is, you know, economic models are models. You know, they're a simplification of the world, because if you end up with a model that's super complicated, you know, then no one will understand it. You know, so that's why, I mean, large language models are wonderful, but you can't engage with them. It's a black box. And that's one big problem in economics. To keep these models useful and manageable, they often don't account for all the negative externalities and all the positive benefits from climate action and so on. So people are constantly refining these, and they're constantly getting better, including in South Africa. And we mentioned some examples in the paper. There's a lot of modeling work happening in this area in South Africa, but we need to change these models to try and capture some of these new synergies. We need to build in some of the gaps in these models so that we can understand this world. So essentially, we need to be able to conceptualize this world so that we can model it. And up until this point, I think, you know, economics, we're, you know, a little bit conservative. So a lot of the gaps in these models is because, I think, just a lack of imagination on the part of modernism. I include myself in this category. So we need to be able to have the data, then we have to add the models so that we can both beforehand predict the benefits, but also afterwards we can then show that they actually materialized. And then, of course, the third, as you mentioned, the third important element is institutional. Like, as Bradley mentioned earlier, these things are difficult to do. You know, we need to climate resilience building becomes a lot better when you have kind of, you know, well-functioning institutions, when you have well-capacitated institutions. I mean, there's no point in, you know, trying to direct funding for adaptation to a municipality if it then can't be deployed, or there's no, or no one is monitoring it and implementing it properly. So we need to build institutional capacity, which is always, we always say, no matter what policy you're talking about, it's always an issue in South Africa, as even more of an issue here. But then we also, I think we need strong central guidance on this. I think it needs to become more of a kind of policy issue that's pushed at the forefront, and is pushed as a development policy, not as an environmental policy. Now, this is, we're addressing all these things jointly. It's not a success if we only end up with environmental protection and nothing else. We need the social, we need inequality to fall, we need poverty to fall, and we need growth. So I think if we can put those three things in place, and also, I mean, that also means more resources for the organizations that has to implement this. Environmental, as I said earlier, environmental, we've got very good environmental rules and processes in South Africa, but often there's very big resource differences between provinces, between municipalities. We should be able to implement these, you know, requirements and rules and regulations properly if you want to get the benefits from them.
Definitely a lot in that, and I would like to wave a magic wand and make it all happen with the urgency that we know this area certainly deserves. Thank you, Brent. Is there anything else you would like to add, Brent or Bradley, both of you? Anything else?
Thanks, Margot. Yeah, Brent has summed up quite nicely in that how important the modeling is. I'm not a modeling expert myself, so I'll let Brent field that question more heavily than me. But yeah, I think everything that your questions were perfectly placed to kind of summarize our paper quite nicely. Just to drive home the core aspect of the paper, which is just that, you know, we're not trying to reinvent the wheel, but we are trying to say that there are alternative ways of looking at sustainable development and, or specifically development, and how if you blend in an aspect of sustainability, you end up kind of picking up on the sides issues of society that maybe you weren't even thinking about. So, you know, inequality and poverty and things kind of inevitably start improving. That's something which, you know, policymakers would love. You know, policies that are set usually end up, you know, barely addressing the implications that they're supposed to address. So, you know, looking at something like this, if it achieves most of what it's meant to achieve, and it can positively impact and have positive spillover effects to socioeconomic issues and to the environment and to the climate, you know, that's something that we think is definitely worth you know, looking at. So yeah, thanks very much for your time, and you know, keep reading the papers and watch the space, I guess.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think it's almost, we've come full circle to what we said in the beginning. If we look at policy being siloed and then having a policy that if it can just do one thing and do it properly, what would that one thing be? But it's an interesting balance to strike. Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Brent?
Well, I think I'd just like to, for once, add on a positive note, because I think, I mean, what we were trying to communicate in the paper is, I think there is a almost unprecedented opportunity here. I mean, this really is, we do have a significant opportunity here. And it's not often that having relatively negative starting conditions actually makes it more likely that you'll succeed. And in a case, that's almost what we have here in South Africa now. Is that our old model hasn't been working. We know we need to try something different. If there's an option that could hit a lot of these benefits at the same time, I think it's worth trying. So I mean, South Africa, like, we all know things have to improve. So I think we should really put our weight behind this. I think we can achieve a lot. I think we have really good resources for all of this. So I think, to get back to what Bradley said, I mean, I agree with him. We definitely shouldn't reinvent the wheel, But I think sometimes you have to try a different bicycle, and I think that's what what we'd like to propose, going forward.
And just on that point, what would you say are the areas for future research for our listeners wanting to pursue this topic?
Well, I mean, we've got a whole section on that in the paper, and it's basically these things we talked about at the end here. It's how do you look, because the growth model is going to rely on, it's multidisciplinary. It's going to rely on a lot of skills all over the place. You're going to need ecologists and scientists and whatever to prove these interactions and synergies and all of this stuff. But really, I think the key thing is going to prove that this is a growth model. So to prove that it's a growth model that can work. So I think that's where a lot of the work has to go in, is to kind of really create the models, upskill, create upskill the create the models, upskill the modelers, plug the data gaps, so that we can really show that this is a viable option. And then I think the sky's the limit.
Great. So to pull out your analogy, go from a bicycle to a modern electric powered, solar powered bicycle.
No, I think we want to go to a spaceship. Let's not. Well, actually, no, we don't want to go to a spaceship, because the planet is already a spaceship, and we shouldn't be trying to go and destroy another climate somewhere else. No, we should move to a we should move to a nice electric vehicle running on green energy. So yeah, that's a great idea.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure to have such distinguished guests on our podcast today. I really appreciate the opportunity having you here today and for you taking the time. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Margot.
Thanks very much, Margot. Really enjoyed it.
And also a big thank you to our listeners. If you'd like to learn more about this research, we will connect all the links to the landing page on the URSA website. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe to our socials on LinkedIn and Twitter. This is your host, Margot G from the URSA podcast series. Till next time.